Very good morning to everyone. The first case this morning is number 033318, Robert Westphal et al. Against Donald Snyder. Mr. Mills.
This case is about TAMS, Illinois Supermax Prison. Supposed to be for the worst of the worst. Those prisoners are so out of control that they simply can't be kept secure, even in the segregation unit in maximum security prisons like Pontiac or Stateville. That's not what these plaintiffs are. You got plaintiffs like Mr. Bivens, who has a grand total of 43 days he spent in segregation for the 14 years he was in prison before going to TAMS. Mr. Burrell, 60 days in segregation. Mr. Knox, never a day in segregation in the 7 years he spent in prison before going to TAMS. Eddie Rodriguez, not one day in segregation, not one day lost good time. Joe Sorrentino was classified as medium security, working in the officer's kitchen before he was sent to TAMS. It's our contention in this case that the plaintiffs in this case were sent to TAMS not because they are the worst of the worst and not for anything that they in fact did that violated security. Rather, they're at TAMS because they're litigators or because someone somewhere has labeled them as associating with gang members. It's now been 6.5 years since TAMS opened. Almost all of my plaintiffs have been there since almost the beginning. They haven't been given a due process hearing. They haven't been given notice of the factual basis for why they're there. They haven't been given any opportunity to rebut whatever facts they are, and there's certainly not been a neutral decision maker to decide whether they're appropriately placed.
Are they sent to TAMS to both it? In administrative segregation and disciplinary segregation?
Those are the labels that the department placed upon them.
Is everybody in some kind of segregation, or is there some other category?
Well, the technical terms are disciplinary segregation and administrative detention. Administrative detention is a phrase which is not contained anywhere in the Illinois statutes. It's one that the department has created itself. It's our contention that everybody at TAMS is in fact being punished, however. That the conditions are essentially identical for all prisoners that are there. The only functional difference between people given the administrative detention label as compared to the disciplinary segregation label is about 2 hours extra outside of your cell. One extra or two extra showers a week, one extra or two extra hours out on the so-called yard, which is not a yard like any of us think about. It's a concrete box roughly the size of your cell.
Are they going to have contact visits? Is that
no contact visits for anybody at TAMS, no matter what level you're in. You're talking to someone chained to a stool through a plate glass window. In fact, there's no movement really at all for anything. You're fed in your cell. There's no jobs. There's no programming. There's no nothing. Whenever you are moved out of your cell, there have to be three guards, depending on your security level, either two or three guards, who have physical contact with you at all times. In fact, there are several prisoners down there who simply won't take visits because it's so humiliating to visit someone in those circumstances. On the retaliation plaintiffs, or what we call in our brief the litigation plaintiffs, it's our contention that the trial court entered summary judgment against them prematurely. It's our contention that that we have two things that satisfied our prima facie case in this case. We have a chronology of events for everybody. In addition, we have some direct statements by several of the defendants threatening people with TAMS or punishment in general based upon their continued litigation or grievance writing or complaints to the press, all clearly First Amendment-related activities.
Does the record tell us how many or what number of writ writers and that sort of thing are not at TAMS?
Are not at TAMS.
No,
that is discovery we sought and was denied by the court. That's one of the issues we've raised in the brief. We asked for, and again, the way this process worked is that the department looked at a large number of people. They began compiling hundreds of names of prisoners for consideration going to TAMS in the spring of
97. It opened in 98, right?
It opened in March of 1998.
They have to get stocked. They have to go through the prison system, all the different prisons in Illinois, and cherry-pick different people to put in.
Right.
This particular spot.
Exactly right, Judge. And defense have admitted in this case that they had no criteria when they're doing that. They just left it to the wardens or whoever the warden delegated it to. there was a committee that sort of reviewed all these things and made sure all the paperwork was together, but they've admitted that there were no criteria that they used. Nothing in writing, nothing orally, there was no agreed criteria.
And you question that.
We have, well, I agree that, I do agree that there wasn't anything written down that they were following. I think that by leaving that sort of discretion, what it meant was that wardens in particular, but lower level staff as well, simply picked the people they did not like, the ones that were pain in the neck, which in this case meant litigators. What we asked for in discovery was...
Did they just transfer people who were just general pains in the neck?
Yes, and I believe that they did do that in some senses. I'm not quite sure what the constitutional basis for that would be, to say that it was purely arbitrary, other than our due process claim.
It's questionable what constitutional objection there is to anybody being placed in any particular prison.
Well, it's undisputed. I mean, the law is well established that if you're sent to TAMS, if you're punished or you're transferred in general to less to a higher security prison in retaliation for filing litigation, that violates the First Amendment.
No, that's different than your gang argument here.
That's correct. We have two separate arguments here. I was starting with the litigation people, but if you want to go to the gang people, I'll be glad to talk about them as well. The gang people were not dismissed on summary. They were not entered summary judgment here. This was dismissed on the pleadings with no proof whatsoever that they were even gang members. All that's in the complaint is that somebody had labeled them at some point as being associated with a gang. And for that, they've been sent down and punished for years on end, again, without any opportunity to challenge that. In fact, of course, they don't use the word gang. They use the word security threat groups now. This is sort of Orwellian labeling. And again, the regulations are extraordinarily broad. They not only say that anybody who is in a gang, but anybody who the department thinks may be planning to join a gang in the future can be sent to TAMS. What I think crucial here, though, is that the plaintiffs in this case say, some say I wasn't ever a member of the gang. I'd like to challenge that. They're just wrong. Some say, well, I was back in the days before 1996, but at that point the department said, join a gang. They thought it was a great idea. It was the way they managed the prison. They actually encouraged prisoners to join up with one organization or another. Or, yes, I was a gang member, but I got out long before I was sent to TAMS. In those circumstances, people have been down there for 6 years without an opportunity to see what it is that they're allegedly to done. I mean, for example, Eddie Rodriguez, who we did do discovery on because he's also a litigation plaintiff, the only thing in his statement that says why he should be there is an alleged FBI report saying he's some leader of the Latin King. But
what if
we asked for discovery and there's no such thing?
What if they just did a lottery to fill TAMS and somebody who had a spotless record said, hey, I don't belong in this place. It's supposed to be for the worst of the worst, and I'm not one of them.
If they
is there a claim there?
If they did it by lottery, I do not think there would be a federal constitutional claim. I think that the legislature would never approve it if they said that what it was doing, and I think there would be a claim under state law. But I think that if they simply randomly select people for TAMS, then there is, the courts have held that there's not a federal constitutional claim.
May we review whether anybody was or was not a member of a gang? On what basis do we review it?
Well, you clearly can't review that because there's no record. That case claim was dismissed on a 12B6 motion, saying that the complaint, even if we're right, that none of them did anything that was not approved by the department at the time, does not state a claim. And that's our contention here. Maybe they can win.
How does it state a claim?
We're saying two things. First of all they've been charged with is associating with somebody else. A freedom of association claim under the First Amendment. Just having lunch with somebody is not something that the government should be able to punish you for. And that's all that's alleged here. We don't know how they identified these people as gang members. All we know is that they said they're associated with someone else and that it's part of a so-called security threat group. They've placed a label on somebody, and because of that label, they sent them off.
Haven't prisons been taken action against people associated with other people since time immemorial, haven't they? I mean, that's part of the problem of being a prison, isn't it?
I don't think it's just because they've been associating with someone. Generally, they have to have done something that violates the regulation, that violates the rule, that violates something, that violates the law. That's why they're there in the first place. We don't send people to prison in this country because they merely associated with someone.
Oh,
because
you know,
they believed in something.
I mean, once they're in prison, you may may object to their association from the point of view of the prison security, and I would assume that's fairly common in prison.
If they could show, and that's the Turner test, if the defendants could come in and show that there was a legitimate security reason for separating people, for sending them to TAMS, then they would win. But this is here on a 12B6 motion. They haven't even answered the complaint yet on the gang question. For all we know, they're going to admit none of these people are in fact in gangs. We just think that they were, so we sent them down to TAMS. This was thrown out on a motion to dismiss. There's certainly nothing in the complaint, and in fact the complaint clearly alleges none of these people have done anything, any actions, no disciplinary record that would have sent them to TAMS, that would justify them being sent to TAMS. That's what the complaint alleges. So all that's in the complaint is an allegation that they were sent to TAMS because someone somewhere said they were associated with something that somebody called a security threat group.
Could I invite your attention to the other group of plaintiffs, your so-called litigation plaintiffs? A moment ago you outlined what evidence the record did contain. Could you outline for us now what evidence the record does not contain but that you contend it ought to contain? In other words, what were you deprived of demonstrating because of the judge's discovery rulings? I'm kind of interested not only in what that information was, but why you believe it was relevant and probative to your case.
The information that we were not able to obtain was really two categories. The principal one was the sort of comparison group, the similarly situated people. This court in the Dunn case criticized, there was a teacher who was fired because I think late, they were late regularly. One of the things that the court criticized was that that teacher had not come up with other people who had similar sort of violations and had not been fired. We asked for not just our plaintiffs, but the pool of people that they considered. Our belief is, from what my clients tell me, that many of those people had worse disciplinary records, had more gang activity, and the only difference between the ones that are not at TAMS and the ones who were selected at TAMS is that those other people had never complained, never filed grievances. They were get-along sort of prisoners.
That's going to be a pretty tall order, isn't it, to pull all that material together and analyze it? And is that really a doable task?
It's certainly well, we don't know who everybody that they consider. We agreed to limit, at least as a start, to the list of people that they had already given us that they considered. So we had a specific list of, I'm guessing, 100 other prisoners who are not at TAMS, and we asked for the materials that they gathered, that the departments put together, the packets they put together, for those other 100 people. Because that contained, at least, while they may be inaccurate, as in our plaintiffs they were inaccurate, but at least they contained the department's position as to gang activity and disciplinary history, and whatever other reason they have as to why they might be considered to TAMS.
And the district court didn't give you that material. What was the rationale?
The district court said it was moot. It didn't really give one. It said our motion to compel that discovery was moot since he entered summary judgment against it. I believe his rationale was that that can't be considered in determining whether or not we had put together a prima facie case.
And you also were deprived of some other information. Were you not, as a sanction?
Well, there's two different things here. There was one other thing we were deprived of in terms of discovery itself, which is trying to determine whether or not the allegations they made about gang membership were true.
Understood, yeah.
They said we couldn't have that discovery, and the judge never gave it to us. But the thing that he struck as a so-called discovery sanction was the evidence that we had in fact gotten from the defendants that the disciplinary histories that they used to justify why these people were in TAMS were false.
If I could interrupt there.
Sure.
False or falsified?
We don't know because we only got them at the very last minute. We just know that they are wrong as a matter of fact.
If they're simply wrong, does that create a constitutional violation?
Well, the question is whether or not a jury, looking at the fact that I believe every single one of these plaintiffs has a wrong disciplinary history, could use that as an additional piece of evidence, in addition to the chronology and the evidence of direct threats, to conclude that in fact a substantial motivating factor for sending people down to TAMS was their litigation. I think the fact that they made consistently such egregious mistakes, and often they've doubled the amount of disciplinary history that there is, or made it up out of thin air, so it's more than double. But consistently, they vastly overstated the disciplinary history of these individuals.
Now, you were not allowed to place that in the record as a sanction, as I understand it.
Well, it is in the record. He just struck it, so, I mean,
yeah.
It is physically in the record.
Okay.
He did not consider it, that's correct.
But, could you, in encapsulated form, tell us why you think that was an inappropriate response to the problem the judge perceived?
Yes, I don't think there was a problem. And, in fact, defendants have really abandoned that argument here in this court. The Rule 26 clearly requires us to update it, but it either requires you to update it in the form of a updated interrogatory or otherwise in writing. We gave them affidavits setting forth what the problem was, exactly. That is, what the problem with disciplinary history was. The only argument is that instead of labeling it affidavit and signed under oath, it should have been labeled supplemental interrogatory answers and signed under oath. And remember, this all happened in the last 6 weeks before we had to file a response. After waiting a year and a half, they finally gave us thousands of pages.
And precisely what had to be amended in the district court's view?
Our answers to interrogatories, which clearly did not specify that they had falsified the disciplinary report.
And what were the 7,500 pages you got at the end?
They were the underlying documents for the disciplinary history. So we spent 6 weeks going through those.
I thought those were withheld as a sanction.
No. He struck our evidence, the affidavits that we submitted, saying that those documents proved it was false.
Right.
We finally got them from the defense.
Finally got them.
And I see my white light is on, so if your honors have no more questions, I'll save the rest for rebuttal.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mills.
Thank you, your honors.
We'll hear now from Mr. Light.
May it please the court. Counsel Eric White, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the defendant's appellees. This case is brought as various constitutional claims. The defendant sees this case also, however, as about the department's ability to maintain order and security in its institutions, to safeguard inmates and staff, all the while housing some of society's most dangerous people. Indeed, as the plaintiffs see it, the plaintiffs' position are not just legally wrong. In some cases, they lead to very dangerous results. The plaintiffs' argument regarding the right of association is a good example. Their position is legally wrong in the sense that the cases clearly identify two situations in which there is a right of association. When a person is trying to associate for expressive purposes, or the right of intimate association. Plaintiffs in this case have not alleged either one of these types of association. They have not alleged that they were associating for expressive purposes or in any sort of intimate purpose.
Do you know of any case that restricts the right of association to these two categories?
The cases that I cited in my brief, I think one is Roberts, talks about these two general lines. There are cases which, for example, there's a Supreme Court case, I don't remember the name offhand, I'm sorry I could get it for you, but where there was a claim that there was a right of association to associate with people of a different age. It would involve a restriction on entrance to a nightclub. And the court held that there was no right of association there. But the plaintiffs have cited no authority that there's this general right of association, nor have they submitted any rationale why this court should expand the right of association beyond the two lines of situations that the courts have already recognized, certainly not in the prison context. Indeed, there's a very good reason not to expand it into the prison context. It would be very bad for prison administration if prison authorities had to worry about rights of association between any two prisoners, not for any expressive purpose or an intimate purpose, but just because I want to associate with the guy in the next wing. Does that mean that the department has to accommodate that right?
Apparently, the state of Illinois took a different position about these kinds of affiliations at an earlier point in its administration of prisons. Is that right?
That's the allegation in the complaint.
So we would have to take it true for purposes of the 12B6 motion.
Correct. So I think, you know, if inmates are associating for purposes of disrupting the prison, or if the prison authorities believe that, then they have to have the ability to basically stop those associations in order to maintain internal security.
No, associations that take place here take place since 1996, when I gather the policy changed.
Well, that's our position. That's how we read the complaint. It says prior to 1996, the department had this policy. I think the only reasonable interpretation of that is that after 1996, the policy changed. And the complaint says that the plaintiffs were transferred to TAMS because they are associated with a security threat group. And they were transferred in 1998 when TAMS opened. So they were transferred for conduct that was occurring in 1998 after the policy had changed, which is goes to one of our ex post facto arguments. Just briefly on the
ex post facto. No, it's your position that they were associated after 1996. Their association didn't cease in 1996, is that correct?
Well, we're basing our argument on what the complaint says. The complaint says they were transferred for associations or alleged associations for present associations in 1998, or whenever they were transferred. The complaint used the present tense, not the past tense, the past associations. A similar analysis applies to the ex post facto argument. Their ex post facto claim is without merit. The ex post facto rule applies to laws. Here what they're complaining about is an administrative policy, a change in administrative policy regarding internal operation of a prison. The rationale behind the ex post facto clause doesn't apply in this case, because prisoners contemplating associating with a prison gang do not have a reasonable expectation that the department's not going to change its policy. Indeed, Illinois law has consistently given the department the discretion to decide where an inmate's going to be placed. And since TAMS is open, regulations have given the department discretion to decide who will be transferred to TAMS. So there's no law involved here, and the ex post facto prohibition does not apply. Regarding the due process claim, that they were not afforded a hearing was appropriately dismissed for two reasons. First, inmates in Illinois prisons do not have an entitlement to avoid transfer from one prison to another. And second, the plaintiffs have not alleged an atypical significant deprivation. First, regarding the entitlement component of this analysis, there is no entitlement in Illinois under either the Due Process Clause or under Illinois law to avoid transfer between prisons.
There are pretty explicit regulations, apparently, though, about transfer to this place.
Right. They do not create any sort of an entitlement to avoid transfer.
Is there explicit statutory criteria, or is it simply regulatory?
Regulatory. And the regulations say that there are considerations that the department may employ in deciding who goes to TAMS.
So but your view is that doesn't create an entitlement.
Does not even purport to create an entitlement. And and also the regulation, I think, clearly says it's a non-exhaustive. It doesn't explicitly say that, but I think it says may include among other things. So it's a non-exhaustive list of considerations. And so it cannot even purport to confer an entitlement to avoid transfer to TAMS. And for that reason, the plaintiffs don't have a liberty interest in avoiding transfer, and therefore, no due process hearing is even required.
If a prisoner is subject to a disciplinary hearing or proceeding in some other prison, is sometimes the transfer to TAMS provided as a punishment, a sentence, or whatever his misbehavior was?
And I do not believe that it's provided as a punishment. It may occur as a result. In fact, for example, if a prisoner commits an especially serious assault, that may result in the department determining that that individual is no longer appropriate for the institution that he's currently in, and that a more appropriate placement would be another institution, either a more secure institution or because he can't get along with people in the institution he's currently incarcerated in. But I do not believe it's specifically designated, you know, this is your punishment, you're going to Stateville.
This is sort of the devil's island of the system, is it?
It's meant to be harsh, and it is harsh, and I don't know how I'd call it devil's island, but yeah.
Analogy occurred to me.
I want you to be master of your own time, Mr. Light, but I would appreciate your addressing at some point the issue of the exhaustion of administrative remedies. It was extremely difficult in both briefs to track the party's positions on this issue, and I would appreciate your view as to why there is an exhaustion problem here.
Well, there's an exhaustion problem because the department's regulations provide for the ability of an inmate to grieve what they believe to be a retaliatory transfer. The regulations say that a person may file a grievance regarding any problem, incident, or complaint, with certain exceptions that aren't applicable. The plaintiffs claim that exhaustion was not even available, but that's belied by this regulation. And it's also belied by the fact that a number of the plaintiffs did challenge, did grieve their transfers to TAMS. They did claim that they were retaliatory transfers. The Administrative Review Board did respond to those claims on the merits, saying, you know, we find your claim to be without merit. They cite one plaintiff, Ronnie Carroll, who got a response to his grievance where the response was that it was not a matter for the ARB. And they claim, well, that means that the whole issue is not grievable at all, therefore no one had to exhaust their administrative remedies.
If you get to the board,
you get to the what?
You can get to, so your view is you can get up to this board.
Right. You have to at least take that chance, take that opportunity, and if the ARB comes back and says no, if they don't respond to your grievance, then you've exhausted whatever remedies are available. If they respond and say, no, you can't use this process, then you've either exhausted or you've got an equitable estoppel argument. But those people, the plaintiffs in this case, Horton, Felton, Vincent Rodriguez, and Santiago, none of them tried to bring a retaliation claim in a grievance.
Get up as far as the board. The decision maker is the assistant deputy director. What?
Well, for the grievance
what
would be the director.
How do you get from the board to the assistant deputy director? I mean, in other words, is this a viable way of making your views known to the officer who makes the decisions?
The decision on a grievance, the final decision on a grievance, is by the director. The director signs off on the ARB's decision. And that's what happened in many of these cases, that the plaintiff challenged, filed a grievance challenging his transfer to TAMS as retaliatory, and the ARB said, we've considered it, it's without merit, and the director signed off on it. And those plaintiffs have exhausted their administrative remedies.
Now, is this chain of administrative remedy that you've set forth separate from the disciplinary?
Yes. These are grievances. This is a grievance procedure. If you find, it doesn't have to be disciplinary. It could be, I'm not getting access to the law library, my transfer was retaliatory. It could be any incident, problem, or complaint.
Does the record tell us if anybody successfully grieved their transfer?
Of these plaintiffs?
Anybody?
No, the record doesn't, as far as I know, tell about that. I guess I would like to give record sites for these grievances where certain of these plaintiffs did file retaliatory transfer grievances and they were considered by the ARB. They were included in the plaintiff's response to the defendant's motion for summary judgment, which I believe is document 102 or 3 in the record. It's Plaintiff Exhibit 8, Combs, Kenneth Combs. Plaintiff Exhibit 19, for example, that's Ronnie Carroll. Plaintiff Exhibit 20, George Harper. Plaintiff Exhibit 21, Burrell, 22, 24, 27. These are all instances where the plaintiffs specifically challenged, I think 27 is specifically where the plaintiffs challenged a retaliatory transfer, and it was considered by the ARB. So the process is available, and the exhaustion plaintiffs failed to take the opportunity to attempt to exhaust their administrative remedies. They claimed that they did, but in fact, if you look at their grievances, what they did was they said they complained about being transferred to TAMS. They said nothing that would hint that the problem with the transfer was that it was in retaliation for their litigation activities. To sufficiently grieve a retaliatory transfer, you have to at least give some hint to the department that that's what you think happened. Otherwise, there's no way for the department to investigate the matter and possibly resolve it. I mean, that's the whole point for having a grievance procedure and the exhaustion requirements, is so that the prison authorities can possibly resolve it before it gets to court. Well, if there's no hint in those grievances that it was retaliatory, there's no way that the department's going to investigate the possibility that they might have been retaliatory.
If you get to the issue of discovery, I think we would be very, your views on that would be very helpful.
Yes, Your Honor. As to the comparison group, there are two groups that they claim were, two categories of documents they claim were denied them. The comparison group of individuals who were not sent to TAMS, they claim are similarly situated. They admitted in the district court that that would only come in on rebuttal. That is, if they had succeeded in establishing their prima facie case of retaliation, that the transfers were motivated substantially by their litigation activities. The district court said, "Well, you haven't crossed that hurdle." You haven't made that initial showing, so...
Did you have to make that initial showing in order to get discovery? I can see where that might be a problem in order of proof during trial, but why is that an impediment to discovery?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not saying that is an impediment to discovery. I'm saying that's a reason why it wouldn't make any difference in this case anyway, because...
Oh, I see.
Right. And that's the same thing with the disciplinary histories. They want to show that the disciplinary histories that were relied upon by the decision makers were not accurate. Our position is it doesn't matter, because they have to show that the decision makers either believed that those histories were inaccurate.
Why wouldn't the chronology, information that the ostensible reason for the transfer isn't truthful, why would that be enough to make out the prima facie case?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, only one plaintiff preserved his chronology's argument. There's only one plaintiff presented a chronology in his appellate brief to this court. What they did was they cited their submission to the district court, 27 pages of chronologies, and said, "Oh, these are chronologies for the rest of the people." We challenged and disputed the chronology with respect to the one person that they did lay out for this court. And if the department wanted to dispute those chronologies for all the other people. We would have had to spend, you know, respond to 27 pages of material without them having to lay it out for this court. I don't think that's, I think it's basically an attempt to evade the page limitation by incorporating materials in the district court that were submitted to the district court. But in answer to your question, the mere fact that the decision makers may have relied on improper information following the fact that someone filed lawsuits, again, I don't think that's enough to raise an inference that, or allow a reasonable jury to conclude that the reason was not the reason that they gave. The other point
about chronology is a matter of evidence, though, isn't it? Not a matter of argument. I mean, I'm not sure I understand why the chronology itself has got to be in your brief.
Well, because the chronology, the evidence sort of is your argument in that case. I mean, you're saying there's a chronology, and here's what they are, and this shows this shows that it was motivated by our litigation activities. Well, I mean, they're intimately connected, I would argue. The other point I'd like to make is that the fact that some of these plaintiffs may have had fewer disciplinary violations than was stated in the transfer sheet. Let me back up. The plaintiffs claimed that a lot of these people had disciplinary histories that didn't warrant their transfer to TAMS. So, look, they only had a few days in segregation, only had a few disciplinary violations over a certain number of years. The fact is that the department transfers people to TAMS not simply based on disciplinary histories that are set forth. Your Honor, I see that my time is
up. Continue. Close up your thought.
Let me just put it this way. Many individuals might have better records than, let me put it, there may be factors that are not reflected in a disciplinary history. A gang affiliation, for example. The department may be aware of an individual's gang affiliation from sources other than what's reflected in the disciplinary history. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Light. Mr. Mills, you have 3 minutes, and we'll make that four, since Mr. Light had a little extra time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I need to address the issue that counsel started with. This is not a case about order and security. Nobody is standing here saying that if the department has evidence that there's an actual disciplinary or security problem that these people have presented, that they can't go to be sent to TAMS. That's what TAMS was supposed to be for. The question in this case is whether TAMS is being used that way. Turner versus Sapley makes it very clear that they have broad discretion. What Turner doesn't do is say that they can just label someone as a problem and then punish them forever. And that's what this case is about. It's about labeling. They've labeled people's administrative detention status rather than disciplinary segregation status and then say, oh, well, they're not entitled to a hearing. They've labeled people as security threat group members, and therefore they say, as counsel just concluded, because we put that label on them, we don't have to do anything else. We can then say, oh, well, their security problem, we can send them off to TAMS apparently forever without giving them any opportunity to rebut that, because otherwise the safety of the institution will be violated.
Have some prisoners been transferred back from TAMS into the rest of the system?
Yes, they have. In fact, I believe 3 of our plaintiffs have since gotten out of TAMS, have been released from TAMS, and there have been certainly several that are not plaintiffs that have been transferred out. However, the vast majority of people who are currently at TAMS have been there for most of the 6 years, 6.5 years that it's been open. So the number of people that are coming out of TAMS is minuscule. Because their sentences are up.
What if crime went down drastically in Illinois, so there were only 300 prisoners in the whole state and they were all at TAMS?
If you mean if TAMS was the only prison left in the
sure.
state.
Well, they decided we're going to put everybody there.
Then clearly sending people to TAMS is not punishment. It's just the way that it's it is part of your sentence. It is the only sentence is being sent to TAMS. It's not punishment for something else. So there's no, I don't see that as implicating the Constitution at all, other than the Eighth Amendment, and this is clearly not an Eighth Amendment conditions case. We are not saying that TAMS on its own violates the Eighth Amendment. This is about how people were selected for TAMS.
If everybody was at TAMS, but then crime started to go up, and then they had to transfer some people to a lesser security place, do you think, under your theory, that everybody at TAMS would have a right to some sort of due process hearings to decide if they should be selected to go to a less secure facility?
I think the answer is no, because they still wouldn't be at TAMS for punishment. It's clear these people are sent to TAMS for punishment, or at least that's what we've alleged in our complaint, is that these people are sent to TAMS to punish them. And it's our contention that if you're going to punish a prisoner, that he's entitled to some sort of a due process hearing. That's the due process argument. But as to the other claims, that you can't punish them because they're litigators. I think that if they opened up all these other prisons and the only people they left at TAMS were litigators, then yes, they would have a claim. But I don't think if they just sort of randomly selected people, that that would be a claim. That's really the flip side of the question somebody asked before, whether or not if these people had been randomly selected, that was enough. I did want to very briefly address exhaustion. I see my time is on. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, exhaustion. The Administrative Review Board ruled in this case, in Ronnie Carroll's case, that they did not have jurisdiction. Now, they have a very nice argument as to why that was a wrong ruling. Nonetheless, it's the Administrative Review Board, which is the final authority. There isn't any appeal under the regulations from that ruling. They ruled that they didn't have jurisdiction to consider these transfers. Maybe somebody could have gone to court and gotten a declaratory judgment in state court that they were wrong about their jurisdiction, but clearly exhaustion does not require us to do that. If the highest body says we don't have jurisdiction, then that should be the end of it. And I don't think everybody is required to go in and ask once they've made that formal ruling. That's their ruling. Yes, they were not consistent.
At what point was that ruling made, sir?
I'm sorry?
Chronologically, at what point was that ruling made? Was it before these others had a chance to get there or after?
Somewhere in the middle. It was made on August 10th, 1998. Some filed after, some filed before. But that's the date at which they made that ruling.
I'll have to ask you to wind up now at this point.
I would just say that in terms of the specificity on exhaustion that they raised, this court has set a very low bar under Ricardo versus Rauch. In that case, all the prisoner said, that was when he was attacked, raped by another inmate, the administration didn't do their job. That's all he said. And this court said under notice pleading that was enough. All of the plaintiffs in this case at least said that, and most of them said a lot more. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel, Mr. Mills and to Mr. Light, for their very fine oral arguments today and for the fine briefs that were submitted in this case. And the case will be taken under advisement.